It is my privilege this afternoon to introduce to you the chairman of this meeting, a longtime friend of AA, who was elected to the General Service Board in April 1957. He was the first psychiatrist to recognize the work of Alcoholics Anonymous and to use AA principles in his own practice. In the early days, when AA was little known, he was instrumental in having Bill, our co-founder, speak before the neurology and psychiatry section of the Medical Society of the State of New York and the American Psychiatric Association. He has written many inspiring articles, among them, The Ego Factors in the Surrender of Alcoholism. I would like you all to meet this afternoon Dr. Harry Thibault.
Thank you very much. This is my third appearance before a convention of AA. 10 years ago at St. Louis, the title of the convention was AA Comes of Age. Now, 10 years later, we are going to discuss the headaches of growing up, namely, taking on responsibility. This is a subject which is close to the medical mind. We are a service profession. We are responsible for the treatment of the sick. This means caring for the individual, whether the illness be of the body, mind, or spirit. The medical man is often called upon first when any one of these three areas becomes ill. Medicine now knows that man cannot be divided into three parts. He may have three aspects, but when he is ill, we have to treat the individual. As a part, over 100 years ago, medicine began to advance in the physical realms. About 50 years ago, medicine made some advances on the psychiatric side. 30 years ago, AA came along and helped us to advance on the spiritual side. As one therapist to another therapist, all of you out there, I welcome you to the healing professions. I might add a little cattily that I welcome you to all the 2 a.m. telephone calls. This meeting gives the medical profession a chance to speak to you as an AA audience. What the speakers have to say will be their own message. I know they all share with me a deep feeling of gratitude that AA is available to help us fulfill our responsibilities for the treatment of the alcoholic, who is a person who is indeed sick in body, mind, and spirit. The first speaker this afternoon is a psychiatrist. His name is Dr. Alexander S. McPherson. And he comes from Montreal. He is a medical specialist in psychiatry. Queen Mary Veterans Hospital there is in charge of the outdoor clinic for alcoholics, the Royal Victoria Hospital, and lecturer in the psychology department of medicine of McGill University. He is also chairman of the subcommittee on rehabilitation of the advisory committee on mental health, the Department of National Health and Welfare, and has written several articles on mental hygiene for professional journals. It is my very happy privilege to introduce to you Dr. McPherson.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it's hard for me to express my feelings at this moment. I never thought I'd be on a panel with such distinguished men as Dr. Thibault and Dr. Block. I notice I'm the only Canadian on this panel, and I hope I can say something of value to you. Because this is Canada, and because our American friends may not be aware that this is a bilingual country, I'd like to say just a few remarks in French for those 40% of the citizens of our country who are French-speaking. Il me fait grand plaisir d'être ici aujourd'hui et à la part des Canadiens du langue anglais de vous souhaiter bienvenue à Toronto. Moi, je suis de Montréal, mais j'ai passé beaucoup des années à Toronto et je suis sûr que vous trouverez ici un accueil magnifique, en effet. I'm happy to see so many people here today. Our department did a follow-up study last year on alcoholics who had been hospitalized in the Queen Mary Veterans Hospital between 1946 and 1951. And at that time, there were 125 names we came up with. Of those, 25 had deceased. So that if this group is anything like that group, one in five of you would not be here today. So if you look to the two people on either side of you and yourself, were you active alcoholics rather than arrested alcoholics, there's a great possibility that one of you might not be here. Incidentally, the average age of death of these 25 people who died was 51 years of age. So I know perfectly well that you can't scare an alcoholic, but if you're subject to being scared, those figures should scare you. As I say, I'm not entirely sure why I'm here today. I think it stems out of something that happened in Montreal last fall. There was a regional bilingual conference of AA, and I had the honor to be asked to address it. It so happened that just prior to that meeting, this article appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. Those of you at the front can see it. It says, "Alcoholics Can Be Cured Despite AA," by Dr. Arthur H. Kane. At that time, being rather at a loss for a subject, I took Dr. Kane's article and discussed it. In all fairness to Dr. Kane, I subsequently acquired his book, The Cured Alcoholic, and have recently read it, and we're going to talk a little bit about that later. I found the Saturday. I feel that this is a valid subject for discussion here because Dr. Kane has written in Harper's Magazine, he's written in the Saturday Evening Post, and has written several books. These reach a wide audience, and AA cannot speak as an organization for itself, and I feel that some public comment is a desirable thing. Last night, as I was getting ready for bed, I picked up the Gideon Bible, and in Genesis 5, verses about 2 to 7, it says, "And she again bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering to the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. But unto Cain and his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted, and if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and slew him. I was a little hesitant to bring the Bible into this discussion, but as one can see, there's a great deal of truth in the Bible, and history does repeat itself. I tried to examine my reasons for why I felt I should bring this passage, and I think the reason was the slaying of Abel by Cain was a violent act. It's an act of great anger. And I think that Dr. Cain's work has aroused great anger. Perhaps there is something in the content of it that that is angry. Certainly it has aroused anger in a lot of people, and I think the way you have responded here to the mention of this is some indication of this. A lot of his criticism is, to my view, unjustified. He says, "Unfortunately, AA has become a dogmatic cult whose chapters too often turn sobriety into slavery to AA. Because of its narrow outlook, Alcoholics Anonymous presents thousands from ever being cured." I cannot agree with this. I think the essential point here, as we talk of AA's growing responsibilities, is that AA, there are practically as many kinds of AA, as I have seen it, as there are members. And I think there is a responsibility in AA not to be too dogmatic, except about one thing, and to have the strength to accept people whose brand of AA is perhaps a little different from your own. I have not visited AA meetings widely across the country, but I've talked to people who have, and I'm told that AA in Chicago is totally different from AA in Montreal, for example. And this is good. We can't leave this article of Dr. Cain's without some reference to the now famous article of Dr. D.L. Davis in 1962. In the Saturday Evening Post article, Dr. Cain quotes Dr. Davis. He says, "The generally accepted view that no alcohol addict can ever again drink normally should be modified." Now, in his book, Dr. Cain gives the gives the complete text of the Davis article, and he points out the emphatic point that Dr. Davis does make. It is not denied that the majority of alcohol addicts are incapable of achieving normal drinking. And this is the important sentence to me. Dr. Davis, the man who claimed to have found seven alcoholics out of 93 who could drink normally, Dr. Davis, in his article himself, says, "All patients should be told to aim at total abstinence." And that, to me, is still the basis of the way I try to treat alcoholics. If what Dr. Cain says is so out of line, why has it aroused so much anger? Now, I think he tends to use generalizations, and he tends to use somewhat inflammatory statements at times. But I think there is some truth in what he says, and the truth is hidden behind a lot of verbiage, and the truth is this. Sobriety is a challenge. Many of you here may have had the experience, and certainly I in practice have seen it a great many times, of sabotage of one's attempts at sobriety. Sabotage can come from many sources. The one that comes most frequently to our attention is sabotage by the spouse. I had a man who used to drink on business trips. He used to take antabuse with him. He went away on a particularly stressful trip that his wife didn't want him to go on, and she forgot to put the antabuse in his bag. In fact, she actually took it out. He packed it himself. I had a man who was trying very hard to stop. He went shopping with his wife. She sort of accidentally, automatically took a case of beer and put it on the shopping cart. These things are not entirely accidents. And if you go into it, you discover that, particularly in this one case which sticks very clearly in my mind, the individual was mean, miserable, surly, and a lousy husband when he was sober. He was meaner, more miserable, and more lousy and broke when he was drunk. But what his wife hoped for him, before she learned better, was that he could just drink a little bit so he'd be happy. What Cain is driving at, and what I think AA has perhaps neglected somewhat in the past, is this question of growth after sobriety. To my view, sobriety alone is not enough. I think you recognize this too, and I think you talk of people being on a dry drunk when they're not drinking, but they sort of wish they were. We set about to try and study this question in a relatively scientific manner. And Dr. Negretti, working in our department at the Veterans Hospital, took three groups of patients. He took patients just admitted to hospital who were active drinking alcoholics. He took arrested alcoholics, mostly members of AA. There is another group in Montreal that has a small number of people who are arrested alcoholics. And he took a normal control group, which was matched with the other two groups for age, sex, religion, so on. To these two groups, he administered two tests. One was a test called the Moody Problem Index. And this is simply a long checklist of common problems that people have, some 300 of them. And they're divided into certain areas, the sexual area, the area of finances, the area of home and family adjustments, and so on. He found, as one would expect, that active alcoholics had many more problems than the other two groups. He found that the arrested alcoholic had many more problems, even after 2 years of sobriety, than the so-called control group, which may have had alcoholics in it or may not. They were just an unselected group of people. He administered a second test, and this was a test of marital adjustment. It was a marital adjustment scale. And again, he found, as one would expect, that active alcoholics had lousy marital adjustments. But he found that the marital adjustment of arrested alcoholics was less good than that of the so-called normal control group. Now this, I think, if we boil it down, is what Dr. Cain is driving at. he says, and I think that we could sum his message up as sobriety alone is not enough. I haven't had wide experience of attendance at AA meetings, but in those I have attended, there has been too little attention, in my view, paid to what happens after sobriety has been achieved. This is not true of the Al-Anon groups. The Al-Anon groups pay a great deal of attention, in my experience, to the adjustments that must be made while the alcoholic is active and after he is arrested. I remember again in Montreal hearing a man, member of Al-Anon, speaking. They're just like two eyes looking at me here. And this was one of the most inspiring talks I have ever heard. And he started in the days of his wife's active alcoholism, but he continued right up to the day of his talking, which was 7 years or so later. And I think that part of the increasing responsibility that AA must show is in this area of continuing to help members of the fellowship to develop after they have stopped drinking. My message today really is that sobriety alone is not enough.
Thank you very much, Dr. McPherson. I am reminded of an incident early in my contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the earliest members of the Board of Trustees was really what might be called a low-bottom drunk. He came from New York, and he tried the fear method. Now, the fear method he used was every morning he had contacts in New York. Every morning he was allowed to go to Bellevue, which is the city hospital, and allowed to look at the stiffs that had died the night before from alcoholism. I said, how'd it work? Well, he said it was all right until about noon, then I had to take a drink to get the pictures out of my mind. He also told me another lovely story, which I think can be well repeated. He says, they always talk about the alcoholic using alcoholic to escape from reality. He said, hell, I never could find it. Our second speaker is a man who has been touched and restored by AA. He is Dr. John M. from Statesville, Georgia. It is my happy privilege to introduce him to you, Dr. John.
Hi, everybody. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And up here, they've got a system of lights. Now, that's why this program runs so good. And I used to be a paratrooper, and they had a little lights by the door, you know, a little red light that came on 3 minutes before you were supposed to jump. And then they turned on a green light, and if you didn't jump, they pushed you out the door. And Beth tells me she's got a hook when this red light comes on. I'm grateful to be here. And I bring you greetings from the 12-step group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Statesboro, Georgia. They all wanted to come, but they couldn't, they said. And I'm grateful because one thing I feel right now is the wonderful help we get from these people that you're hearing talk here on this platform, Dr. McPherson and Dr. Thibault and Dr. Block. You know, These men volunteered to come here into AA to help us, and they've been doing it for years. They've tried to help the sick alcoholics, and they did it of their own free will. I'm here because I had to be. There was nowhere else to go. I'd worn out the doctors and the psychiatrist and everything, and there was nowhere to go. And I feel most inadequate to fill this spot. And that reminds me of a story. Down in South Georgia, where I live, there's a big swamp called the Okefenokee Swamp. And on the edge of this swamp, there are two schools that have an intense football rivalry. And they play hard every year. And this particular year, neither team had won a game, and it was the last game, and it was the last quarter. And they had about 5 minutes to go, and one team had the ball first down on the other team's 3-yard line. And the coach went down the line, and he yelled over to the quarterback, and he says, "Give the ball to Calhoun." And they ignored him, and somebody else carried the ball, and he made no gain. And second down, and the coach got a little more upset, and he says, "Give that ball to Calhoun." They still ignored him. Made about a yard. It was third down, and 2 yards to go, and he got a little more upset, and he said, "Give that ball to Calhoun." They still ignored him. Made a yard. Somebody else carried the ball. It was fourth down, the last chance to make the touchdown. Had 1 yard to go, and the coach leaned over. He says, "Give the ball to Calhoun." And the quarterback turned around and says, "Calhoun don't want the damn ball." I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 18 years old, and I did it on impulse. I was a student at Emory University in Atlanta taking pre-medical work. I eventually became a physician. You wouldn't believe it from what I learned about alcoholism about myself, because I couldn't stay sober in spite of my medical degree. I don't know why I took this drink. Now, I had been, I guess you might call, a model child. I was brought up in a home where people did not drink. It was a church-going home. I was a Methodist, Protestant, and I don't know whether they taught me or whether I just got the idea that decent people didn't drink, and I was opposed to it. I was a prohibitionist. And so suddenly one night when I took this drink, it shocked everybody. And before that, I had believed that people who did not drink, people who drank, really had no reason for it, that there was nothing that they could get out of a bottle. But once I got this first drink, I couldn't see why everybody didn't drink. I heard a speaker yesterday afternoon say, "The trouble with trouble is it starts as fun." And, you know, that's the way it was with me. It was a wonderful feeling that I had. Gosh, I got on this stuff, and I got drunk that night, and they poured me in my bed, and I swore off the next morning. I was an alcoholic from the first drink. I swore off for about 6 months or so, and I tried it again, and I got drunk again. I said, "This stuff is wonderful, but you got to control it. You can't drink all you want." And from then on, I entered on a long period of controlled drinking. And to me, alcoholism is controlled drinking. I did it through willpower. I would cut it off at night when it was time to go to bed. I would eat some eggs and a chocolate milkshake because I had to work the next day. And I did this very effectively for a long time. My alcoholism is a story of a gradual loss of control, and which means loss of willpower, so that when I came to AA, I had used up all my willpower. There wasn't any left. And I had lost control completely. I had switched from the alcohol to the drugs. I went through medical school. I got married. And I picked a very lovely girl. I think anybody who is going to be the most prominent doctor in Georgia certainly needed a society girl, and I got one. And we were in love, I think, and we stayed married a long time. And I left her, and I went overseas. And then when I came back, I was drinking heavily, but something had happened to this girl. Now, she no longer was the person that I thought she was when I married her. She developed resentment. She was on the telephone all the time talking to her mother about my drinking. And I could not see why she continued to be attached to her mother so much when the marriage ceremony said forsaking all others, you know. She should have been coming to me with her problems, but she wasn't doing this. And I beat her up a few times, and it didn't help her. This girl finally left me, and we got a divorce, and I haven't seen her since. She was a wonderful girl, but I learned a lesson from her. I never did mistreat my present wife quite that badly, I don't think. But I knew then a woman would leave you. I didn't think they would leave a nice guy like me, but she did. I got married again to Dot, who's here with me now, and we've been in AA together for some little time. 6 years, as a matter of fact, tomorrow morning. Tomorrow is my birthday, July the 4th. And I got married to Dot. We started trying to make this thing together. Now, I don't like a doctor who drinks treating me. And I didn't... I deep down didn't believe that maybe I ought to be drinking. And so I began to go into a very convenient little accessory that every doctor has. Two of them, as a matter of fact. One is his little black bag and his little narcotic prescription privilege. And the other is his sample cabinet. And the drug houses just keep this thing full of the most wonderful medicines you ever saw. It's beautiful, all different kind of colors and most of it habit forming. I started going into this thing because, see, when I'd wake up in the morning and I had to have that drink and I couldn't take it, I'd have to take something else. I found a substitute, and I started taking codeine. And I took this codeine in increasing amounts because you must increase a narcotic once you start it. I ran into something that is characteristic of drugs that I know now that I don't think I really understood at the time, and that is there's no such thing as a drug that will do just what it's supposed to do and nothing else. Every drug has a side effect. I don't care what it is. Every one of them has a side effect. And as I took this codeine, it relieved my hangover beautifully, but it began to make me nauseated, see? So I took Bromonil and Barbital for my nausea. This, too, has a side effect, and I began to get sleepy from it, so I took Benzedrine to wake me up. This made me nervous, so I took Nimbutal to calm me down. This was a terrific thing. We doctors call this treating yourself symptomatically, and I did a good job of it. I treated myself symptomatically. Every little ache and pain, I had a different pill. And I kept taking so much of this stuff until one night I had a convulsion. And I didn't know what caused it. They all thought I had a brain tumor because you don't go telling people about this self-medication process you're going in. And I wound up in a hospital and fractured a vertebra in this thing. And then I eventually made my first... serious thought of suicide. I had left this hospital and gone down to Florida to sort of rest up a little bit and convalesce for a month or so I could go back and stay sober the rest of my life, you know. I got down there, and I ran out of dope. I was taking codeine, and I started drinking. And I drank so much one night that I decided that I would swim across the Gulf of Mexico. And I made it about 10 yards out, and I got tired, and I got thirsty, and I came back for another drink. And I passed out, and I came to, really, several days later. It was sort of hazy to me what happened in a psychiatric hospital in Asheville, North Carolina. Now, I had read somewhere that alcoholism, that the excessive drinking and alcoholism is a symptom of a serious underlying nervous or emotional disorder or mental disorder. And I reasoned that if I could find out what this disorder was and I could correct it, that I wouldn't have to drink so much. And so I started going to see psychiatrists, and I went to see many of them. I went to North Carolina, I went to Atlanta, I went to Florida, I went to New Canaan, Connecticut to see Dr. Tahoon, who had an article last month in the wonderful man. I'll tell you something else about him in a minute. But I went to New York to places, always with the same result. On this trip to Silver Hill, Connecticut, something big happened to me, but I did not recognize it. They told me there that I had an alcohol problem, and he may have told me I was an alcoholic. I didn't listen to it if he did. He told me that I should get on a balanced life, which I knew I should have. He says you're disorganized, and there's no question about it. When a doctor's making rounds on his patients at 3:00 in the morning and waking them up to ask them how they feel, he's disorganized. And he asked me to get on a routine of living, which I think was excellent. But one of the things he gave me was a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, to read. And this was my first contact with AA. This was in 1953, and he said, read this, it may help you. And I read it, and I said, this is a wonderful book for the alcoholic. When I get back, I'm going to send all my alcoholic patients to this fellowship. Now, there's one story in there that's just like mine, a doctor's story very much like mine, but I saw none of this in myself. I came back on this psychiatric routine. I was still seething with resentments. I was not getting my patients back as rapidly as I thought I should, and I was blaming this on the other doctors because they were talking about me, you know, this sort of deal. And yet I got along. I stayed I stayed on food and water. I didn't take any pills or any alcohol or anything. I realized, I think, about this time that I did have an addictive personality. That means that I can get hooked on an empty capsule if you told me it'd make me feel better, see. And I knew I had to leave it off then, and I did. But this was an incomplete program. There was no spiritual support. There was no real self-understanding in it at all. One day, on this routine of exercise I had, I went out to play golf, and I caught this index finger in the car door, and I slammed it, and I broke it. And I came in that night, and it was hurting real bad. I said, "Doc, I read somewhere, and I knew I was a narcotic addict." And I didn't know really I was an alcoholic then, I don't think, but I knew I was a narcotic addict. I read somewhere, always reading stuff, you know. I read somewhere that a recovered alcoholic who had been successfully rehabilitated could take narcotics in case of an emergency, providing it was administered under the direction of a physician. I am a physician. I will prescribe for myself 100 milligrams of Demerol, and I took it. It was 5 years before I was off everything completely. I went from one place to another. I don't know then that I ever really thought that I had an alcohol problem. I knew I had a narcotic problem. I was so mixed up from tranquilizers and sedatives and other things that my mind couldn't work clear any way you look at it. I could take Equinil, these other tranquilizers that were available then, and I wouldn't need to drink so much. I could take alcohol and leave it. I could drink a half a can of beer and set it down. It broke up the compulsive pattern of drinking, and this confused me because I was able to convince myself that, gosh, alcohol is not a real problem. It's this other stuff, and I set out to stay off of it. It wasn't until I came to AA and really took an inventory and saw that every time that I got on this other stuff, it started from drinking. That drinking was the basis of it. That when I had been in hospitals many places to get off narcotics or the other things, that I always put that little reservation about the alcohol in there. And I drank often when I was under psychiatric care and never bothered to tell the psychiatrist about it, see. Things got worse with me. I got real bad off. And along in the spring of 1959, I got on Demerol. Demerol real bad. And I think I began to get something then that could get through to me a little bit, get me some help. I think I got a desire for something better. I don't think I got a desire to stay sober, a desire to stop drinking or taking dope or anything. I got sick and tired of living the way I was. I was 49 years old. I'd been practicing medicine since 1937. I had nothing. I'd lost one family. I was heavily in debt. I had practically no patients left that were or making no money out of it anyway. I was in an awful condition, and I wanted something better. And I told Dot that I have sent many of my patients to the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm going up there, too, because I need to go. I had a little white Thunderbird then that I rode around in, a little convertible, and a little white hat I used to wear with this Thunderbird. See, I rode around in this convertible all the time because when you're on this dope, you get pale. And if you ride around in enough sunshine, sometimes you'll get a little color, see? And I was conscious of this thing. And so I rode around sometimes even when it was raining, see? But I started out from Kentucky for Kentucky, and I had a little dope with me, and I had to get some more before I'd go on 50 miles from a doctor friend of mine. I had long since gotten to the point where they wouldn't let me have any narcotics in Statesboro. I had to go to Savannah. I had to put up all these fictitious people and relatives, and then I had to, all types of violations of the Harrison narcotic law to get myself dope, see, and write these prescriptions and drawing on the goodwill of other people and deceiving them in order to get myself something to take. And I started off on this thing. And I got up there, and I went in, and I said, "I'm going to stay about a year." Well, I went in this hospital, and I'd read these little brochures. I don't know whether you've ever been there or not, any of you, but the brochures look real good. It's a beautiful building out on the countryside of Kentucky there in the Bluegrass region, and it's a lovely building. And I had visions of this place. I had been told that they had prisoners there, but I thought they had the prisoners over here in all these bars, you know. And then they had the little the volunteers, which is what I was, over here in little cottages with nurses where they were going to look after you know, especially me, a doctor, that would get special privileges. I always did. But I went in this place, and they had them all there together. And they gave everybody a number. And they gave me number 55280, and this hurt. If they'd have called me Dr. 55280, I think I'd have felt better. But they didn't do that. And they put Dr. Mooney in there with a bunch of common dope fiends. and this I didn't like. Oh, and I got to looking at that thing, and I said, brother, this has done you good. This is shock treatment. This is what's going to happen to you if you keep on messing with this stuff. And I realized then that I had a narcotic and alcohol problem, and I had to stay off of dope and alcohol the rest of my life, or I was going to be in there. And I swore off, and I said, I'll never touch it again. And when you swear off, there ain't no point in staying a year. I might as well go on then, see? So I signed out of this place. And I got my little Thunderbird back, and I started back to Georgia. And I was riding down Tennessee, and I had made this decision never to drink again. I was coming down U.S. 25 toward Knoxville. And I said, never again. And you know, I was happy with this because I was sincere. I had really made this decision not to drink anymore, and I felt real good about it. I came to a sign that said, last chance to buy whiskey before Knoxville. Knoxville was dry then. And I got to thinking, just because I'm going to quit doesn't mean that everybody else has got to quit. I've got a friend named Jim that lives in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. I want to spend the night with Jim. Jim likes a drink. I'll stop and buy him a little bottle just as a little favor for Jim. So I bought 2/5 of Canadian Club. I got back in the car, and I remembered that Jim had moved from Tennessee to South Carolina 2 years before, but I'm stuck with the liquor. What do I do? Take it back? No, I save it for my other friends. So I get on to a little hamburger joint in Knoxville, and I got to thinking about this business of staying sober the rest of your life. You know, that's a long time. And anybody that's really sworn off, that doesn't intend to ever drink again, surely it's all right to take a few drinks today. I'm way up in Tennessee. So I started drinking. Well, I drank that night, and I got to Gatlinburg, and I wound up the next day in the Gatlinburg jail. I got locked up in 3 states trying to get back to Georgia. I couldn't get away from the I couldn't get away from the liquor. This thing got through to me. One big point about my recovery, I think, was, see, I was alone on this trip, just me and the bottle and the Thunderbird, and I couldn't keep out of trouble. And it dawned on me that other people had been looking after me. I had been protected from my own disease and the consequences of my own disease, I'd rather say. On this trip to New Canaan, Connecticut, it's a 1,000-mile trip up there nearly, and I went in an ambulance with a special nurse, see? And nothing gets through to me. I think that I'm looking after myself when I'm not. Other people are looking after me. When I got this trip, it got through to me that when I wasn't even able, within my own power, while under the influence of this stuff, to drive down the road without getting in trouble. I came back and I found myself in bad trouble. First of all, I got drunk at home and they put me out, and I finally wound up in a hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, and as miserable and sick as I'd been up till then. And in the meantime, they had picked up some of these little prescriptions that I'd put around, and they had had warrants out for my arrest. And about 2 o'clock in the morning of July the 4th, 1959, the officers walked in and arrested me and on these charges. And I had about a third of a bottle of Canadian Club left. And I said, can I take a drink? And they said, yes. Where you going? You're not going to get one. So I took a drink, and that was my last drink. And you know, it's an interesting thing about this. I quit drinking 1,000 times. Every time I got drunk, I quit. Every time I came out of one of these psychiatric hospitals, I quit drinking. Taking dope, never again. This time, I did not quit. I didn't know what kind of trouble I was in. But I said, whatever it is, told myself this, when I get through, I'm coming back and finish that bottle of alcohol, because that bottle of Canadian Club. But I was locked up for 5 months after that. And during that period, I met this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and found out I didn't have to quit, that all you have to do is stay away from it one day at a time. I went back to Georgia, and I stood in the little courthouse in Statesboro where I've lived all my life, listening to myself there, just listening to the judge read the indictment of the grand jury, and I pled guilty to the charge of illegal possession of Demerol, one bottle. I pled guilty to that charge because if it looked further, they'd have found 1,000. He sentenced me to 2 years at the Reidsville State Prison. And he turned to me and says, John, I don't think you're a criminal. I think you're sick. And I'm going to probate this sentence, providing you'll go back to Lexington, Kentucky, and stay there until these doctors release you. I went back to Lexington, and I thanked him, because I know that I knew that's what I needed. I needed treatment more than I did a prison term then, I think. And I got a break when I was on the bottom, too. And I think that's important for the alcoholic, that we get a break when we're ready for it. I went back up there, and I didn't go in a Thunderbird. I went in an airplane with a deputy sheriff. And he informed me that if I tried to leave before those doctors released me, that he was going to come up there and get me and put me in that Reidsville prison. And I didn't like that. I went back to AA, or rather back to this hospital, and I went back to the people that I thought could help me more than any others, and that was a psychiatrist. They had worked hard with me, and I applied for psychiatric treatment. They gave me 3 hours of interviews and told me unless I was willing to stay longer than the 6 months that it was going to take to do this, satisfy this court, that they would not undertake to treat me. It would take 1, 2, 3 years. They didn't know that I needed a complete analysis. And I turned it down. I turned it down because I think of a little streak of honesty. I knew that after I'd been there a while and after I got to feeling better and my blood got to circulating again, see, and I could walk and climb a flight of stairs, that I was coming out of this place. I wasn't going to stay. And I knew that I might be in worse condition than I was if I broke this up too soon. So I turned it down and he said, if you won't take our treatment, you had better go to AA. And brother, you better put yourself in that program because there's nowhere else to go. They assigned me a job as editor of the little AA paper in there. AA fell on me. It smothered me in this place. I could not dodge it. And I started working. I'd never went looking for AA. I came into this thing and AA was literally thrust upon me in my stupidity. In my ego, in this terrible shell that I had around myself, I don't think I could have gotten it any other way. You had to come and give it to me and force it there. I started going and I started working the program as best I could in there, and I started studying the 12 steps, and I began to take an inventory and began to look at the first step as to what was powerlessness. And I began to see that I couldn't imagine having any fun or really being relaxed without alcohol or dope. And to me, this meant powerlessness. If I've got to depend on this drug, alcohol or some other drug, for serenity, for happiness, for peace of mind, for fun, then surely I'm powerless over this thing. There must be some other answer to it. I was standing up there one day in the ward, looking out through the bars at a herd of Angus cattle that they had there. And these cattle were loose. They were wandering around this field, and there was a little fence that any one of them could have pushed over. And I got to thinking, here these cows are that are going to be slaughtered, are running around loose, and they got Mooney with all his college degrees locked up. What gives? Why is this? What's wrong? And all I could do, I sought through that in my mind to try to see why I was there. And the only thing I could come up with was that if I hadn't been drinking liquor and shooting dope, I wouldn't have been there. And I began to look at the importance of the drug on what had happened to me. There are plenty of people, I realize, who are emotionally disturbed, who are psychoneurotics, all of which I had been called, that don't go around staying drunk all the time like I did. See, they find other solutions. The trouble was with my solution, not with the problem. Whatever the problem, my solution was to run away, to hide in a drug, in some type of drug. I stayed in there for a while, and I began to look at myself, and I could see, as I think anyone will who takes an inventory, I was much worse off than I thought I was, much worse off. As the time came to leave, I got shook up because I knew I had to stay off of this stuff to live, and I could not see how I could do it. Could not see any way out of it. And I think God comes to see us at times like this and sends us something we need. See, I had been going to AA in an institution. You can't get any liquor or dope in an institution much anyway. We had been using AA for everything except to stay sober. My sponsor from Frankfort, Kentucky, Houston S., arranged for two of us to go to an outside meeting at the downtown group there, the Token Club in Lexington, Kentucky, which was my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I walked into this meeting, and I saw those people there. My first impression was they're all on something. They're all on dope or something like that. I couldn't imagine people being that happy without something, and I soon found out they had nothing. They had some type of feeling, some type of support that was foreign to me. I did not know what it was. But they communicated the idea to me that they did have something, and if I wanted it, I could have it too. And I came out of there with a feeling there was something in AA that I could have if I wanted it bad enough. It gave me hope. And I think to me, this was a second step where I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I came out of there, I went back to that thing with this big idea of something, there being a way out, knowing that I was going to die if I drank again, and knowing that I could not keep from drinking. This was a terrible dilemma, and yet there was some answer. The next day, I caught an airplane to go to Atlanta, and when the time came to leave, to change planes in Atlanta, I was unable to climb up the steps, physically unable to go. I found myself in a motel room that night as sick and miserable as I've ever been, terrified, wanting to die when I had nowhere else to go. I got down on my knees and I prayed to God to do something for me. I didn't know what I wanted or anything. I didn't have any faith or hope that God would help me. But I think I had something I've never had before. I think I had humility. This terrible feeling went away instantly, and it's never come back. I came back, and I got in AA. I found out that I had to live this program one day at a time. That God would help me if I would let Him. I found out that I had been using drugs as a substitute for God. That I had put my faith in alcohol. I've been living on food and water ever since. And this fellowship, your love, this wonderful compassion, this wonderful feeling that you have for me that I know that I can feel, has kept me going for 6 years now. It's not very long, but this is the longest I've ever stayed sober. I don't have the need to drink anymore. I don't have the need to take pills or narcotics. To me, life has become beautiful through this fellowship. Our family is together. Our children are coming in Alateens. My wife is in here, too. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful to you and for the redeeming power of Almighty God as revealed to me through this fellowship that keeps me sober today. Thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you very much for that stirring talk. At my first AA meeting in St. Louis, there was another doctor who spoke with equal eloquence. I don't know why it is that AA speakers are able to move us so much, but I'm sure it's because they've been through something which has been deeply meaningful to them. Our third speaker was Dr. Marvin A. Block. Dr. Block is an old friend of mine. I've known him for many years. I've always admired him for his energy. He's been a pioneer in the field of alcoholism and has served the field very, very well. He is a member of the medical faculty of the State University of New York, Buffalo, the past chairman of the American Medical Association's Committee on Alcoholism, and it was his enthusiasm, incidentally, which really saw that that committee was formed. He served as officer or director of numerous health organizations. The list of his activities is so long that I can't do any more than say he has been a very busy man, an extremely useful man. Recently, he has written a book, Alcoholism, Its Facets and Its Phases. I take great pleasure in introducing to you as our third and last speaker, Dr. Block.
Dr. Thiebaud, distinguished guests, and fellow workers, I'm always relieved when the introductions are over. Ever since the time I addressed a very large medical audience, and the chairman, in attempting to get some information with which to introduce me, wrote to my office and asked for some facts that he could give to the audience for the introduction. And then he got up and he introduced me, and he went on for a little while, and finally said, I was very surprised to learn from Dr. Block's secretary that for the last 20 years he's had an all-consuming interest in alcohol. Many of the stories I tell come from my own practice, and I hesitate to tell these stories very often because I've been accused of plagiarizing my own stories. The last meeting I went to out in Salt Lake, I was talking to a group, and apparently I had previous speakers, and one of the stories that I started to tell about 10 years ago was told, apparently, and I didn't know it. So when I got up, I told the story. My wife was out in the hall, and when the people came out of the room, they said, why, he took that from so-and-so. He told that story. This was my original story, and if I have time, I'll tell it to you. Some of you may have heard it. I once thought of that, by the way, I hate to read papers. I even hate worse to write them. But they insisted that I write this paper, and so I always punish them by reading it. I once thought that if a human body were to come off an assembly line, as automobiles do, it would be much simpler to care for that body when it did not function properly. However, one day an automobile worker who was employed on the assembly line corrected me. He told me that the variation on the assembly line in the same make of cars was tremendous. The reasons he gave was that the workers on the line, human beings, entered into the variation not only in the assembly, but in the mechanics of the machines themselves. He said, if a worker is irritable because he did not sleep well, had an argument with his wife, or had indigestion the night before, one might find... Guess we won't have any trouble there. It's all right. One might find several nuts would not be screwed on tightly, some might be left off completely, an electrical connection might be loose, or some small defect might be overlooked. This human element, unpredictable, frustrating, but nevertheless fascinating, is an omnipresent characteristic which may determine a great part of our lives. Alcoholism is a serious, insidious, progressive disease, but the term is a general one, without much meaning unless we get down to the details of its ramifications. It means many things to many people. Like cancer, it is but a term that covers a multitude of conditions with but one characteristic in common. The term cancer means many things to many people. Also, to each that hears the term comes a mental image which depends upon his experience, observation, and emotional involvement. The only thing that is characteristic of all cancers is the excessive growth of tissues wherever they are. Each type, however, is a different condition and must be approached from a different viewpoint. The term alcoholism is also a general one, and to each who hears it, again an image comes to mind, which also depends upon his experience, observation, and emotional involvement. The only characteristic common to all alcoholics is excessive drinking. When one thinks of alcoholism in these terms, one has a little better understanding of why it is that all alcoholics do not respond to the same type of approach, that some alcoholics might respond to one type of treatment, while others might respond to another and different remedy. It has been said repeatedly, particularly by many in the medical profession, that alcoholism is but a manifestation of an underlying constitutional, physiological, or psychiatric disorder. You just heard the previous speaker say that. This is but a matter of semantics, for I can think of no illness which would not answer that description. We know that any illness involves a host, a vector, and then the environment surrounding both the agent and the host. Not all people exposed to the same agent will develop the disease. Not all people who are exposed to the same environment. But why one will succumb to an illness and others will not still remains an unexplained mystery. This applies to the infectious diseases, mental illness, metabolic problems, and others of the illnesses which befall mankind. Most of us are adequately exposed to the vectors at one time or another, be they infectious, chemical, or psychological. Many theories have been advanced regarding the matter of natural protection, antibodies, conditioned response, chemical reactions, general resistance, and others. For some illnesses, the answers have been specific. For others, they remain obscure. And for still others, we have no answers at all. It can be said to the credit of Alcoholics Anonymous that if they had not demonstrated that alcoholics could recover, the movement toward helping alcoholics would not be as popular as it presently is. For many years, there have been individual physicians who have considered alcoholism as a disease and try to influence their colleagues and the public generally that alcoholics require treatment rather than punishment. However, it was not until comparatively recently that this attitude has assumed appreciable proportions. When Alcoholics Anonymous was founded, and when its co-founders, as well as those with whom they worked, demonstrated that alcoholics could recover under proper circumstances, a great deal more interest was generated by the public and in the medical profession in seeking new and better methods of bringing about such recovery. When in 1956 the American Medical Association officially recognized alcoholism as an illness which properly falls within the purview of medical practice, a great step was taken toward a possible breakthrough in the treatment of this problem. As most are aware, Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual approach to the illness. The spiritual attitude in any illness is an extremely important factor in the recovery of the patient. When I have a patient without faith, I feel his chances for recovery are decreased. Without faith, the problem in helping him to recovery is much more difficult. However, it is generally recognized also that faith alone will not always bring about the desired result. There are some cases, I am sure, that recover completely through faith. They do. Innumerable instances of such recoveries have been recorded, for faith can and does modify the actual physiology of the body. Studies on stress reaction and the effect of faith demonstrate this. As I stated in the beginning, however, all human beings are not alike. They do not come off an assembly line, and even if they did, there would be sufficient variation among them to make a difference in their response to the same stimulus and to different stimuli. There are, therefore, any number of alcoholics who can respond to the spiritual approach to this problem. There are also perhaps as many, or perhaps more, who cannot. Does this mean that Alcoholics Anonymous has no place in their lives? It certainly does not. It does mean, however, that Alcoholics Anonymous alone may not be enough to bring them to recovery. This must be recognized by everyone, particularly those in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it has proved successful with some individuals, does not mean that it will prove successful for all others. The same thing might be said of the medical treatment of alcoholics. There are some alcoholic patients who make excellent recoveries through the use of medicine and psychiatry, but not all may recover through these measures, and some do better with the spiritual approach which is offered by Alcoholics Anonymous. So we must consider that for the sake of the patient and his welfare, no stone must be left unturned which might help him. In other words, the more approaches that can be used for helping the patient recover, the better chance the patient has of attaining that recovery. Cooperation, then, between all the agencies interested in treating alcoholics is of the essence. Each has its place in helping the alcoholic, but each must recognize that he may not have the answer for all alcoholics. Generally speaking, a combination of all the facilities available perhaps offers the best approach. As I read the various issues of the grapevine, I get the impression that most members of Alcoholics Anonymous agree with this premise. There is, however, a very vocal minority who do not see this picture in its entirety, who are still so egocentric that the impression is given by this small group that AA and AA alone can help the alcoholic. It falls in line with the old oft-quoted cliche that only an alcoholic understands an alcoholic. To the physician who has spent years studying and successfully treating illnesses from which he never suffered, this cliche sounds somewhat preposterous. Still, it is not uncommon to find Alcoholics Anonymous members whose lack of security is so threatening that they insist to new members that only AA can help them and that doctors neither know nor care about alcoholic patients. To be sure, there are physicians who do not and will not treat alcoholics and who even refuse to do so. There are all kinds of physicians, just as there are all kinds of AA members and all kinds of alcoholics, but we must not judge all by the few. And this reminds me of the story that was repeated, that there are all kinds of doctors. Some of you may have heard this, I'm sure. Some years ago, I had a patient who came to me, and, you know, after you talk with these patients long enough, you begin to judge very quickly whether they've been around or not. And I gathered from what this man said that he'd made the rounds, and I finally said to him, "I'm not the first physician you've seen for your problem, is it?" He said, "No, I went to my own doctor." I said, "Who is your doctor?" And he mentioned his name, and I recognized the name. I said, "Well, what did he say?" He said, "I went to see him several times." I said, "Yes, but what did he say?" He said, "Well, the last time I went to see him, he said, 'My boy, forget about this alcoholism business. You're no more alcoholic than I am.'" And I never heard a more accurate diagnosis. Pretty tough, as some people will testify, for a doctor to tell a patient that he's alcoholic when the patient drinks less than he does. Just as we are trying to teach all physicians that alcoholics are sick people that are their responsibility to treat, there must be an attempt to teach all AA members that medicine and psychiatry can also help people suffering from alcoholism. There's one big difference, however, in this otherwise comparable situation. In the medical schools and hospitals, there are students and young physicians who learn from their teachers and preceptors the principles of the practice of medicine. If they do not meet the requirements of medical training, they run the risk of being refused the right to practice. In Alcoholics Anonymous, however, there's a very distinct permissiveness which allows each member to do as he sees fit, to say what he wishes, and to speak his mind, whether he is right or wrong. While this liberty is a valuable one, he can often give a wrong impression, and no one has the authority to stop him. While he cannot speak for AA officially, neophytes in the fellowship often regard him as knowledgeable because he has sponsored them or because he has obtained sobriety, a criterion which, in my opinion, is only partially indicative of success. Because this individual does not drink, he is looked upon by others as having successfully met the requirements of Alcoholics Anonymous. If one studies the 12 steps carefully, one can see that in order to live the program, one must carry out a great deal more than just attaining abstinence. This places upon Alcoholics Anonymous a far greater responsibility than is generally recognized, even by many of its members. But a responsibility which, if carried out, will greatly enhance the stature of the fellowship and benefit its members immeasurably. It is easy to be critical of anyone or anything. Constructive criticism, however, can be a valuable contribution. As I get around among recovered alcoholics, regardless of how they have succeeded, I find a great many who have recovered through AA but have grown away from the fellowship. I use the term grown away because so many have stated that they no longer find interest in the meetings devoted to reiteration of drinking experiences. Having been abstinent over a period of years, they have completely accepted abstinence and no longer feel the necessity for going to meetings. For those who have attained this degree of emotional maturity and feel happy in their lives of abstinence, I suppose there is no reason to complain of their absence at meetings. What a terrible loss their absence is, however, for the newcomer, the beginner in AA. How much these successful people could contribute to the beginner who is so discouraged and depressed, so resentful of his enforced abstinence, so dependent upon others, or so ashamed all too often of his inadequacy and imagined weakness. One of the greatest incentives for continuing abstinence is the presence of others who have achieved this goal and are happy in it. This is denied the unfortunate initiate if the older, successful, and happier members lose interest in coming to meetings. Their lack of interest, however, is understandable. It can be boring to hear over and over again the stories which to them are all too familiar, but which no longer are part of their lives. Those who have lived by the 12 steps know them well and have accepted them as a way of life. To go over them repeatedly might be tedious when one has accepted them as a part of living. It would be like a discussion of honesty among men who are essentially honest and who have accepted honesty as a way of life and who wishes no other way. What is there to discuss? For those successful members, a newer and more stimulating interest might be found to attract them to meetings for the benefit of the less fortunate ones. Visiting teams of such people who have attained more than just sobriety, but also insight, knowledge of human motivations, and a greater understanding of the other factors involved in the problem of alcoholism might be stimulating enough to bring some of these people back to meetings with a broader program than just to maintain abstinence. The public health approach, the broader understanding of emotional factors, even the better understanding of the physiological aspects and psychological aspects of the problem might supply the added incentive to learn more about the problem which they may have resolved for themselves, but which plagues so many others. This does not mean that they must break their anonymity, change any of the steps, or modify in any way the principles of AA as they exist. What it might do is to stimulate them to do more as citizens, without themselves becoming emotionally involved, for correcting the problem in a general way rather than working only with individuals. If it will only bring them to meetings to discuss these aspects of the problem, it will help to rekindle an interest which, if not of benefit to them, would certainly be of benefit to many newer members trying to start up the hill of recovery. Contrary to the feeling which many have that alcoholics like to drink, it is important that everyone recognize that it is not the drink he likes. There are many beverages which he could drink if drinking were his only purpose. We must appreciate that it is the drug that he wants, the effect of the drug, just as any drug dependent wishes for the effect which it produces. For the alcohol dependent, it is the escape into one reality that he wants, to an unreal world which is more comfortable than the real, more uncomfortable, highly competitive, and often unhappy world. But it is the only world we have, and if we are to improve it, it must be in a real way and not in an artificial, unreal way. As I've said to patients so often, if it makes you wealthy to walk around with a wad of $100 bills in your pocket, do so. But if it's stage money, whom are you fooling? Even you know it's not real. Do you really feel wealthy? This is the kind of comfort one gets from alcohol. Make-believe. Unreal. Once this is understood, the alcoholic can see before him the road which he must traverse to accept reality to the best of his ability and within the limits which we all have. This is the real humility which must be felt, that all humans have limitations, and that to accept them is one more mark of maturity. The difference between the mentally healthy person and the mentally unhealthy one is the ability to face the realities of life. The normal human runs an extremely wide range of ability to meet these realities. Some can take more than others when it comes to accomplishment. To aspire to greater heights than one has the capacity for achieving means continual frustration. And when the individual cannot take these frustrations and disappointments and cannot accept the fact that he has limitations, as all other humans have, then he is prone to blame everyone and everything else but himself. To face the fact that he has limitations and that his aspirations go beyond them is something which many human beings cannot accept. To avoid facing this reality, many attempt to escape into unreality. In the more severe cases, where they can take very little of this adversity, some people will resort to a little world of their own to which they retire. This is a severe mental disturbance in many cases, which requires complete custodial care and careful rehabilitation over long periods of time. Less severe reactions to this same type of inability to cope with reality are attempts to escape in other ways. Normal escapes, such as reading, movies, television, sports, and so on, temporarily relieve the person from facing these realities, and often engaging in these normal escapes, he returns to reality refreshed and ready to cope with his problems again. However, there are some in between these two types who cannot face the realities and wish for temporary surcease in an unreal fashion. The use of drugs, including alcohol, is the measure to which these individuals resort to escape this real, uncomfortable situation. Unfortunately, drugs act not only psychologically on these individuals, but physiologically as well. This is not appreciated by many people who use them. Since they seek surcease and realize it through the use of drugs, alcohol, barbiturates, narcotics, amphetamines, they continue to use them for the relief which they give, a kind of self-medication which gives them the comfort which seems to alleviate the suffering they feel. However, when one stops to think that besides the psychological reactions which these drugs have, there is also a physiological reaction, that the tissues of the body actually become dependent upon the presence of the drug, then one can appreciate how, over a long period of time, the tissues adapt themselves to the presence of the drug to such an extent that they feel that they cannot get along without it. At this stage, the alcoholic or the individual is hooked. But it is at this stage that the alcoholic begins to feel that he cannot continue without drinking. The answer to this problem does not lie in bringing to recovery those people suffering from the illness. Since complete recovery of all the alcoholics living today would not solve the problem if a succeeding new generation of alcoholics takes their place. Therefore, a change of attitudes and environment is extremely necessary, as well as early case finding. This is the only hope for preventing the progress of the problem. In order to detect these cases at the very earliest stages, some of our old concepts must be revised. The idea that the individual must be ready for treatment must be discarded. He must be induced to accept treatment long before he is ready to ask for it. This necessitates a tremendous educational program for the entire population, alerting them to the dangers of alcohol and alerting them also to the very earliest signs of dependence upon the drug, whether it be psychological or physiological. Since the psychological effects precede the physiological effects in most cases, it is these signs which must be readily recognized. To err in the diagnosis is possible, but if it is done on the safe side, the individual who may be deprived of a minor part of his living may still be saved from the tragedy which it often brings. It is to this end that we must devote our time and our efforts so that the interest of both the medical profession and of Alcoholics Anonymous together will be able to help to recovery those people suffering from the illness. To prevent the illness in those who may eventually become alcoholics, and to bring to the attention of those in the very early stage of the illness, the necessity for treatment, psychological, physical, and spiritual, will help prevent the progress of the disease. It is to this end that we must devote our efforts. Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Block for his very stimulating paper and for his willingness to suggest to AA that there are ways in which their program can be enriched. Certainly AA has not got all the final answers. They're growing, just as the medical profession, too, is growing in its understanding and insight into this problem. I also want to take this chance to thank you people for coming and hearing from the medical profession. We have our friends with you, and you are our friendship ourselves. I want to now close this meeting in the usual fashion. Will you all rise? Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever.